Side 8, The Different Engine, by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 271. There were soldiers with bayoneted rifles on the street corners in Piccadilly, in modern speckled drab and slouch hats. They were eating porridge from mess kits of stamped tin. Mallory waved cheerily at these minions of order, but they glared back at the Zephyr with such militant suspicion that he quickly stopped. Some blocks on, at the corner of Longacre and Drury Lane, the soldiers were actively bullying a small squad of bewildered London police. The coppers milled about like scolded children, feebly clutching their inadequate billy clubs. Several had lost their helmets, and many wore rude bandages on hands and scalps and shins. Tom stopped the Zephyr for coaling, while Fraser, followed by Mallory, sought intelligence from the London coppers. They were told that the situation south of the river was quite out of control. Pitched battles with brickbats and pistols were raging in Lambeth. Many streets were barricaded by pillaging mobs. Reports had it that the Bedlam Hospital had been thrown open, its unchained lunatics capering the streets in frenzy. The police were sooty-faced, coughing, exhausted. Every able-bodied man in the force was on the streets. The army had been called in by an emergency committee, and a general curfew declared. Volunteers of the respectable classes were being deputized in the West End and equipped with batons and rifles. At least, Mallory thought, this litany of disaster crushed any further doubts about the propriety of their own venture. Fraser made no comment, but he returned to the Zephyr with a look of grim resolution. Tom piloted on. Beyond authority's battered boundary, things grew swiftly more grim. It was noonday now, with a ghastly amber glow at the filthy zenith, and crowds were clustering like flies in the crossroads of the city. Clumps of masked Londoners shuffled along, curious, restless, hungry, or desperate, unhurried and conspiring. The Zephyr, with merry toots of its whistle, passed through the amorphous crowd. They parted for it reflectively. A pair of commandeered omnibuses patrolled Cheapside, crammed with hard-faced bruisers. Men waving pistols hung from the running boards, and the roofs of both steamers were piled high and bristling with stolen furniture. Thomas easily skirted the wallowing buses, glass crunching beneath the Zephyr's wheels. In Whitechapel there were dirty, shoeless children clambering like monkeys, four stories in the air, on the red-painted arm of a great construction crane. Spies of a sort, Brian opined, for some were waving colored rags and screeching down at people in the street. Mallory thought it more likely that the urchins had clambered up there in hope of fresher air. Four dead and bloating horses, a team of massive Percherons, lay swollen in Stepney. The stiffened carcasses, shot to death, were still in their harness. A few yards on, the dray itself appeared, sacked, its wheels missing. Its dozen great beer casks had been rolled down the street, then battered open, each site of rapturous looting now surrounded by a pungent, fly-blown stickiness of spillage. There were no revelers left now, their only evidence being shattered pitchers, dirty rags of women's clothing, single shoes. Mallory spotted a leprous plague of bills, slapped up at the sight of this drunken orgy. He hit the top of the Zephyr with a flung lump of coal, and Tom stopped. Tom decamped from the gurney, Fraser following him, stretching cramps from his shoulders and favoring his wounded ribs. "What is it?" "Sedition," Mallory said. The four of them, with a wary eye for interference, marched with interest to the wall, an ancient posting surface of plastered timber, so thick with old bills that it seemed to be made of cheese rind. Some two dozen of Captain Swing's best were freshly posted there, copies of the same gaudy, ill-printed broadside. The bill featured a large winged woman with her hair afire, surmounting two columns of dense text. Words, apparently at random, had been marked out in red. They stood silently, attempting to decipher the squirming, smudgy print. After a moment, young Thomas, with a shrug and a sneer, excused himself. "I'll see to the gurney," he said. Brian began to read aloud, haltingly. "An appeal to the people. Ye are all free lords of earth, and need only courage to make triumphant war on the whore of Babylondon and all her learned thieves. Blood, blood, vengeance, 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 plagues, foul plagues, etc., to all those that hearken not to universal justice. Brothers, sisters, kneel no more before the vampire capitalist and the idiot savantry. Let the slaves of crowned brigands grovel at the feet of Newton. We shall destroy the Moloch steam and shatter his rocking iron. Hang 10 score tyrants from the lampposts of this city, and your happiness and liberty be guaranteed forever. Forward, forward! We take hope in the human deluge. We have no recourse but a general war. We crusade for the redemption of the oppressed, of the rebels, of the poor, of the criminals, all those who are tormented by the 7 cursed whore, whose body is brimstone, and who rides the nightmare horse of iron. There was much more. What in the name of heaven is the wretch trying to say? Asked Mallory, his head buzzing. I've never seen the like of this, murmured Fraser. It's the ranting of a criminal lunatic. Brian pointed at the bottom of the bill. I cannot understand about these so-called 7 curses. He refers to them as if they were dreadful afflictions, and yet he never names and numbers them. He never makes them clear. What can it be that he wants? Mallory demanded. He can't think that a general massacre is any answer to his grievances, whatever they may be. There's no reasoning with this monster, Fraser said grimly. You were quite right, Dr. Mallory. Come what may, no matter what risk, we must be rid of him. There is no other way. They returned to the Zephyr, where Tom had finished the coaling. Mallory glanced at his brothers. Above their masks, their reddened eyes shone with all the stern courage of manly resolution. Fraser had spoken for them all. They were united. There was no more need of words. In the very midst of this low squalor, it seemed to Mallory a moment of true splendor. Touched to the core, he felt his heart soar within him. For the first time in seeming ages, he felt redeemed, clean, utterly purposeful, utterly free of doubt. As the Zephyr rolled on through Whitechapel, the exultation began to fade, replaced with a heightened attention and a racing pulse. Mallory adjusted his mask, checked the workings of the baluster Molina, exchanged a few words with Brian. But with all doubt resolved, with life and death awaiting the coming roll of the die, there seemed little enough to say. Instead, like Brian, Mallory found himself inspecting every passing door and window with a nervous care. It seemed that every wall in Limehouse was spattered with the wretch's outpourings. Some were vivid madness, pure and simple. Many others, however, were cunningly disguised. Mallory noted 5 instances of the lecture posters that had libeled him. Some might have been genuine, for he did not read the text. The sight of his own name struck his heightened sensibilities with a shock almost painful. And he had not been the only victim of this clear kind of forgery. An advert for the Bank of England solicited deposits of pounds of flesh. A seeming offer of first-class railway excursions incited the public to rob the wealthy passengers. Such was the devilish mockery of these fraudulent bills that even quite normal adverts began to seem queer. As he scanned the bills, searching for double meanings, every posted word seemed to decay into threatening nonsense. Mallory had never before realized the ubiquity of London's advertisements, the sullen omnipresence of insistent words and images. An inexplicable weariness of soul struck him as the Zephyr rumbled on unchallenged through the macadamed streets. It was a very weariness of London, of the city's sheer physicality, its nightmare endlessness, of streets, courts, crescents, terraces, and alleys, of fog-shrouded stone and soot-blackened brick. A nausea of awnings, a nastiness of casements, an ugliness of scaffoldings lashed together with rope, a horrible prevalence of iron street lamps and granite bollards, of pawn shops, haberdashers, and tobacconists. The city seemed to stretch about them like some pitiless abyss of geologic time. An ugly shout split Mallory's reverie. Masked men had scuttled into the street before them, shabby, threatening, blocking the way. The Zephyr braked to a sudden stop, the coal wain lurching. Mallory saw at a glance that these were rascals of the roughest description. The first, an evil youngster with a face like dirty dough, in a greasy jacket and corduroy trousers, had a mangy fur cap pulled low, but not low enough to hide the prison cut of his hair. The second, a sturdy brute of 35, wore a tall, grease-stiffened hat, checked trousers, and brass-toed lace-up boots. The third was thick-set and bow-legged, with leather knee-breeches and soiled stockings, a long muffler wrapped round and round his mouth. And then, rushing from inside a plundered ironmonger's, two more Confederates, hulking, idle, slouching young men, with short, baggy shirt sleeves and trousers too tight. They had armed themselves with spontaneous weapons, a goffering iron, a yard-long salamander. Homely items these, but unexpectedly cruel and frightening in the ready hands of these bandits. The brass-booted man, their leader, it seemed, tugged the kerchief from his face with a sneering yellow grin. "Get out of that carriage," he commanded. "Get the hell out!" But Fraser was already in motion. He emerged with quiet assurance before the five jostling ruffians, for all the world like a schoolteacher calming an unruly class. He announced quite clearly and firmly, "Now that's no use, Mr. Tally Thompson. I know you, and I should think you know me. You are under arrest for felony."
"That be damned,"
blurted Tally Thompson, turning pale with astonishment. "It's Sergeant Fraser," shouted the dough-faced boy in horror, falling back two steps. Fraser produced a pair of blued iron handcuffs.
"No," Thompson yelped, "none of that. I won't stand them. I won't bear none of that."
"You will clear the way here, the rest of you," Fraser announced. "You, Bob Miles, what are you creeping round here for? Put away that silly ironware before I take you in."
"For Christ's sake, Tally, shoot him,"
shouted the muffled ruffian. Fraser deftly snapped his cuffs on Tally Thompson's wrists. "So we have a gun, do we, Tally?" he said, and yanked a derringer from the man's brass-studded belt. "That's a shame, that is." He frowned at the others. "Are you going to hook it, you lads?"
"Let's hook it,"
whined Bob Miles.
"We should hook it, like the sergeant says."
"Kill him, you jolterheads,"
shouted the muffled man, pressing his mask to his face with one hand and pulling a short, broad-bladed knife with the other.
"He's a fucking copper, you idiots! Do for him! Swing'll choke you if we don't!"
The muffled man raised his voice.
"Copper's here!"
he screeched, like a man selling hot chestnuts.
"Everybody, come up and do for these copper sons of bitches!"
Fraser lashed out deftly with the butt of the derringer, cracking it against the muffled man's wrist. The wretch dropped his knife with a howl. The three other ruffians took at once to their heels. Tally Thompson also tried to flee, but Fraser snagged the man's cuffed wrists left-handed, yanked him off balance, and spun him to his knees. The man with the muffler hopped and hobbled back several paces, as if dragged against his will. Then he stopped, stooped over, picked up a heavy-toppled flat iron by its mahogany handle. He cocked his hand back to throw. Fraser leveled the derringer and fired. The muffled man doubled over, his knees buckling, and fell to the street, writhing in a fit.
"He's killed me," the ruffian squawked. "I'm gut shot. He's killed me."
Fraser gave Tally Thompson an admonitory cuff on the ear. "This barker of yours is rubbish, Tally. I aimed for his bloody legs."
"He didn't mean no harm," Tally snivelled.
"He'd a 5-pound flat iron." Fraser glanced back at Mallory and Brian, where they stood astonished in the coal wain. "Come down, you lads. Look sharp now. We'll have to leave your gurney. They'll be looking for it. We have to hoof it now." Fraser yanked Tally Thompson to his feet with a cruel jerk of the cuffs. "And you, Tally, you'll lead us to Captain Swing."
"I won't, Sergeant."
"You will, Tally." Fraser hauled Tally forward with a sharp beckoning glance back at Mallory. The five of them picked their way around the squealing, choking ruffian, who rolled in his spreading blood on the pavement, his dirty bow legs trembling in spasm.
"Damn me if he don't take on," Fraser said coldly. "Who is he, Tally?"
"Never knew his name."
Without breaking step, Fraser slapped Tally's battered top hat from his head. The wrinkled topper seemed glued to the ruffian's scalp with grime and macassar oil.
"Of course you know him."
"No name,"
Tally insisted, looking back at his lost hat with a leer of despair.
"A Yankee, innit?"
"What sort of Yankee, then?" asked Fraser, scenting deceit. "Confederate? Unionist? Texian? Californian?"
"He's from New York," Tally said.
"What?" Fraser said in disbelief.
"You tell me he was a Manhattan communard?" He glanced back once at the dying man as they walked on, then recovered himself swiftly and spoke with tepid skepticism. "He didn't talk like any New York Yankee."
"I don't know nothing about any commoners. Swing liked him is all."
Fraser led them down an alleyway crossed with rusty elevated catwalks, its towering brick walls glistening with greasy damp.
"Are there more like that when in Swing's council? More men from Manhattan?"
"Swing's got a deal of friends,"
Tally said, seeming to recover himself.
"And he'll do for you, he will. You trifle with him."
"Tom," said Fraser, turning his attention to Mallory's brother, "can you handle a pistol?"
"A pistol?"
"Take this one," said Fraser, handing over Tally's derringer. "There's but one shot left. You mustn't use it lest your man is close enough to touch." Having rid himself of the derringer, Fraser then reached, without pause, into his coat pocket, pulled out a small leather blackjack, and commenced, while still walking steadily, to batter Tally Thompson with numbing accuracy on the thick meat of his arms and shoulders. The man flinched and grunted under the blows, and finally began to howl, his flat nose running snot. Fraser stopped, pocketed his truncheon.
"Damn ye for a fool, Tally Thompson," he said with a queer kind of affection. "Know you nothing of coppers? I've come for your precious Swing all by meself, and brought these three jolly lads just to see the fun. Now where's he lurking?"
"A big warehouse in the docks," Tally snivelled. "Full of loot, wonders, and guns, whole cases of fancy barkers."
"Which warehouse, then?"
"I dunno," Tally wailed. "I never been inside the bloody gates before. I don't know the bloody names of all them fancy go-downs."
"What's the name on the door? The owner?"
"I can't read, Sergeant, you know that."
"Where is it, then?" Fraser asked relentlessly.
"Import docks or export?" "Import."
"South side, north side?"
"South, about middle ways."
From the street behind them came distant shouts, a frenzied shattering of glass, and drum-like echoed booms of battered sheet metal. Tally fell silent, his head cocked to listen. His lips quirked.
"Why, that's your carriage," he said, the whine gone from his voice. "Swing's lads have come back hotfoot and found your carriage, Sergeant."
"How many men in this warehouse?"
"Listen to 'em breaking her up," said Tally.
A queer variety of childlike wonder had chased all fear from his sullen features.
"How many men?" Fraser barked, boxing Tally's ear.
"They're knocking her to smithers,"
Tally declared cheerily, shrugging from the blow.
"Blood's work on your pretty gurney. Shut your trap, ye bastard!"
young Tom burst out, his voice high with rage and pain. Startled, Tally regarded Tom's masked face with a dawning leer of satisfaction.
"What's that, young mister?"
"Shut up, I told ye," Tom cried.
Tally Thompson leered like an ape.
"It ain't me hurting your precious gurney. Yell at them, boy. Tell them to stop, then."
Tally lurched backward suddenly, snatching his manacled hands from Fraser's grip. The policeman staggered, almost knocking Brian from his feet. Tally turned and screeched through his cupped hands,
"Stop that fun, my hearties!"
His howl echoed down the brickwork canyon.
"You're hurting private property!"
Tom pounced on the man like lightning, with a wild spinning swing of his fist. Tally's head snapped back, and the breath left him in a ragged gasp. He tottered a step, then dropped to the cobbled floor of the alley like a sack of meal. There was a sudden silence.
"Damn it, Tom," said Brian. "He knocked his lights out."
Fraser, his truncheon drawn now, stepped across the supine ruffian and peeled one eyelid back with his thumb. Then he glanced up at Tom mildly.
"You've a temper, lad."
Tom tugged his mask free, breathing shakily.
"I could have shot him,"
he blurted, his voice thin. He looked to Mallory with a strange, confused appeal.
"I could have, Ned. Shot him down dead."
Mallory nodded shortly.
"Easy, lad."
Fraser fumbled to unlock the handcuffs. They were slick with blood from Tally's lacerated wrists.
"That was mortal strange what the rascal just did," Brian marveled in a hushed Sussex drawl. "Are they bedlam crazy here, Ned? Have they all gone Ellinge, these London folk?"
Mallory nodded soberly. Then he raised his voice.
"But note that a good right arm don't cure."
He whacked Tom's shoulder with an open palm.
"You're a boxer, Tommy lad. You blowed him down like a slaughtered ox."
Brian snorted laughter. Tom smiled shyly, rubbing his knuckles. Fraser rose, pocketing truncheon and cuffs, and set off up the alley at a half trot. The brothers followed him.
"It wants so much," Tom said, his voice giddy.
"What?" Mallory objected. "A mere lad of 19, laying out that brassy boots brawler? It's a marvel, surely."
"It weren't any fair fight, with his hands bound," Tom said.
"One punch," Brian gloated.
"He stretched him flat as an oaken plank, Tommy."
"Stow it,"
Fraser hissed. They fell silent. The alley ended by the vacant ground of a demolished building, its cracked foundation strewn with bits of red brick and graying spars of splintered lumber. Fraser picked his way forward. The sky rolled yellow-gray overhead, the haze breaking here and there to reveal thick greenish clouds like rotting curd.
"Hell bells," Tom declared,
in a tone of thin jollity.
"They can't have heard us talking, Mr. Fraser, not with that almighty racket they were making on my gurney."
"It isn't that lot worries me now, lad," Fraser said, not unkindly. "But we might meet more pickets."
"Where are we?" Brian asked, then stumbled to a halt.
"God in heaven,
what is that smell?"
"The Thames," Fraser told him. A thick wall of low brick stood at the end of the vacant plot. Mallory hoisted himself up and stood, breathing very shallowly, his mask pressed hard to his bearded lips. The far side of the brick wall, it was part of the Thames embankment, sloped down 10 feet to the riverbed. The tide was out, and the shrunken Thames was a sluggish gleam between long plazas of cracked, muddy shore. Across the river stood the steel navigation tower of Cuckold's Point, adorned with nautical warning flags. Mallory could not recognize the signals. Quarantine, perhaps? Blockade? The river seemed nigh deserted. Fraser looked up and down the mud flats at the foot of the embankment. Mallory followed his gaze. Small boats were embedded in the gray-black mud, as if set in cement. Here and there along the bend of the Limehouse Reach, rivulets of viridian slime reached up through the gouged tracks of channel dredgers. Something like a river breeze. Not a breeze at all, but a soft, liquid ooze of gelatinous stink rose from the Thames and spilled over them where they stood.
"Dear God!"
Brian cried in weak amazement, and knelt quickly behind the wall. With a sympathetic ripple of queasiness, Mallory heard his brother retch violently. With a stern effort, Mallory mastered the sensation. It was not easy. Clearly, the raw Thames surpassed even the fabled stench in the holds of Royal Artillery transports. Young Thomas, though he'd also gone quite pale, seemed of tougher stuff than Brian, inured perhaps by the chugging exhaust of steam gurneys.
"Why, look at this nasty business," Tom suddenly declared in a muffled, dreamy voice.
I knew we'd a drought upon the land, but I never dreamt of this." He looked to Mallory with astonished, reddened eyes. "Why, Ned, the air, the water, there's never been such a dreadfulness, surely." Fraser seemed pained. "London's never what she might be in summer."
"But look at the river,"
Tom cried innocently.
"And look, look, yonder comes a ship."
A large paddle steamer was working her way up the Thames, and a very queer-looking craft she was indeed, with her hull flat as a raft's and a cheese-box cabin of sloping riveted iron, the walls of black armor patched bout astern with large white squares, cannon hatches. On her bow, two sailors in rubber gloves and nozzled rubber helmets took soundings with a leaded line. "What sort of vessel is that?" asked Mallory, wiping his eyes. Brian rose unsteadily, leaned across the wall, wiped his mouth, and spat. "Pocket ironclad," he announced hoarsely. "A river gunship." He pinched his nose shut and shuddered from head to foot. Mallory had read of such craft, but had never seen one. From the Mississippi campaign in America. He stared beneath a shading hand, wishing for a spyglass. "Does she fly Confederate colors, then? I didn't know we'd any of her class here in England." "No, I see she flies the Union Jack."
"See what her paddle wheels do," Tom marveled. "That river water must be thick as neat's foot jelly."
No one saw fit to remark on this observation. Fraser pointed downstream. "Listen, lads. Some rods away lies a deep-dredged channel. It leads into the moorings for the West India docks. With the river this low, with luck, a man might creep through that channel to emerge within the docks unseen." "Walk over the mud of the shore, you mean to say?" Mallory said.
"No," Brian cried. "There must be another stratagem."
Fraser shook his head. "I know those docks. They've an 8-foot wall about 'em, topped by a very sharp cheval de frise. There are loading gates and a railhead, too, but they'll be close guarded, sure. Swing chose well. The place is nigh a fortress." Brian shook his head.
"Won't Swing guard the river, too?"
"Doubtless," Fraser said. "But how many men will stand sharp lookout over this stinking mud, for Swing or anyone else?" Mallory nodded, convinced.
"He's right, lad." "But it'll daub us neck to foot with smeechy filth," Brian protested.
"We're not made of sugar," Mallory grunted.
"But my uniform, Ned. Do ye know what this dress coat he cost me?" "I'll swap ye my gurney for that shiny gold braid," Tom told him.
Brian stared at his younger brother and winced. "Then we must strip for it, lads," Mallory commanded, shrugging out of his jacket. "Like we were farmhands, a-pitching sweet hay on a nice Sussex morn. Hide that city finery in the rubble, and be quick about it." Mallory stripped to the waist, tucked his pistol in the belt of his rolled-up trousers, and lowered himself down the embankment wall. He half-slid, half-hopped to the evil mud below. The riverbank was as hard and dry as brick. Mallory laughed aloud. The others joined him, Brian coming last. Brian kicked a cracked dinner plate of mud with his waxed and polished boot.
"Damn me for a fool," he said, "to let you talk me out of uniform."
"Pity," Tom taunted.
"You'll never launder the sawdust out of that fancy forage cap."
Fraser, removing his collar now, was in white shirt and braces, surprisingly dandyish items of watered scarlet silk. A new shoulder holster of pale chamois held a stout little pepper-box pistol. Mallory noted the bulge of a neat padded bandage beneath the shirt and strap.
"Don't go griping, lads," Fraser said, leading the way. "Some folk pass their very lives in the mud of the Thames."
"Who's that, then?" asked Tom.
"Mudlarks," Fraser told him, picking his way. "Winter and summer they slog up to their middles, in the mud a low tide, hunting lumps of coal, rusty nails, any river rubbish that will fetch a penny."
"Are you joking?" Tom asked.
"Children, mostly," Fraser persisted calmly.
and a deal of feeble old women.
I don't believe you, Brian said. If you told me Bombay or Calcutta, I might grant it, but not London.
I didn't say the wretches were British, Fraser said. Your mudlarks are foreigners, mostly. Poor refugees.
Well then, Tom said, relieved.
They tramped on silently, breathing as best they could. Mallory's nose had clogged solid, and his throat was thick with phlegm. It was a relief of sorts to be spared the sense of smell. Brian was still muttering, a monotone to match their tramping step. Britain's a sight too hospitable to all these damn foreign refugees. If I'd my way, I'd transport the lot to Texas. All the fish here must be dead, eh? Said Tom, stooping to rip up a china-hard platter of mud. He showed Mallory a mash of flattened fish bones embedded in it.
Look, Ned, the very image of your fossils.
They reached an obstacle a few yards on, a dredger's muddy hollow, half-filled with black silt, marbled with veins of vile pale grease like the leaves from a pan of bacon. There was no help for it but to leap and dodge and splash across the ditch, and Brian had the evil luck to miss his footing. He came up foully smeared, licking muck from his hands and cursing wildly in what Mallory took to be Hindustani. Beyond the ditch, the crust grew treacherous, plates of dried mud skidding or crumbling underfoot, over a pitchy, viscous muck full of ooze and bubbling gas pockets. But there was worse luck yet at the entrance channel to the docks. Here the channel's banks were close-packed tarred pilings, slick with greenish fur and oily damp, rising 15 feet above the waterline. And the water itself, which filled the broad channel from bank to bank, was a chilly gray sump, seemingly bottomless, writhing with leg-thick wads of viridian slime. It was an impasse. Now what's our course? Asked Mallory grimly. Swim?
Never!
Brian shouted, his eyes reddened and wild. Scale the walls, then?
We can't!
Tom groaned, with a hopeless look at the slimy pilings.
We can scarcely breathe!
I wouldn't wash my hands in that damn water! Brian cried, and my hands are caked in stinking muck.
Stow it, Fraser said. Swing's men will hear you, sure. If they catch us down here, we'll be shot like dogs. Stow it, and let me think.
My God, the stink!
Brian cried, ignoring him. He seemed near panic.
It's worse than a transport. Worse than a Rusky trench. Christ Jesus, I saw him bury weak old pieces of Rusky at Inkerman. And that smelled better than this.
Knife it, Fraser whispered. I hear something.
Footsteps. The tramp of a group of men coming nearer.
They've got us,
Fraser said in sharp desperation, gazing up the sheer wall and putting a hand to his pistol.
Our number's up. Sell your lives dear, lads.
But in one moment, a series of instants shaved so thin as to be normally useless to the human mind. Inspiration blew through Mallory like a gust of alpine wind.
Don't,
he commanded the others, in a voice of iron conviction.
Don't look up. Do as I do.
Mallory began to sing a shanty, loudly, drunkenly.
At Santiago, love is kind, and we'll forget those left behind. So kiss us long and kiss us well, Polly and Meg and Kate and Nell. Come on, you lads, he urged cheerily with a boozy wave of his arm.
Tom and Brian, direly puzzled, chimed in the chorus, faltering and belated.
Farewell, farewell, you jolly young girls. We're off to Rio Bay. Next verse, Mallory crowed. At Vera Cruz the days are fine. Farewell to Jane and Caroline.
Ahoy!
Came a brusque shout from the top of the wall. Mallory glanced up in feigned surprise to see foreshortened bodies. Half a dozen marauders were looming over them, rifles slung over their backs. The speaker crouched at the top of the pilings, his head and face swathed in kerchiefs of knotted silk paisley. He held a gleaming, long-barreled pistol with seeming carelessness across his knee. His trousers, of white duck, looked immaculate.
Ahoy the shore! Mallory shouted, craning his neck.
He flung his arms wide in jovial greeting and almost toppled backward. "How might we be of service to you, Flash gentlemen?" "Here's a conundrum," the leader announced in the elaborate tone of a man casting pearls of wit before swine. "Just how very lushed, how utterly well pissed indeed can four London pigeons be?" He raised his voice. "Can't you smell that dreadful stench down there?" "Surely," Mallory said, "but we want to see the India docks." "Why?" The word was cold. Mallory laughed harshly. "Because it's full of things we want, ain't it? Stands to reason, don't it?" "Things like clean linen," said one of the other men. There was laughter mixed with grunts and coughing. Mallory laughed too and slapped his naked chest. "Why not? Can you lads help us? Throw us down a rope or the like." The leader's eyes narrowed between his paisley wraps, and he tightened his grip on the pistol butt. "You're no sailor. A Jack Tar never says rope. Rather, he always says line." "What's it to you what I am?" Mallory shouted, scowling up at the man. "Throw us a rope, or a ladder, or a bleeding balloon, or else go to hell." "Jolly right," Tom chimed in, his voice shaking. "Who needs you lot, anyway?" The leader turned, his men vanishing with him. "Hurry up," Mallory bellowed as a parting shot. "You can't keep all that fancy swag to yourselves, you know." Brian shook his head. "Jesus, Ned," he whispered, "this is a damn tight pinch." "We'll pass as looters," Mallory said quietly. "We'll pose as drunken rascals, primed for any kind of mischief. We'll join their ranks and make our way to swing." "What if they ask us questions, Ned?" "Act stupid." "Halloo!" came a shrill voice from above. "What's that?" Mallory cried roughly, looking up. It was a masked and scrawny boy of 15 years or so, balanced atop the pilings with a rifle in his hand. "Lord Byron's dead!" the boy yelled. Mallory was dumbstruck. Tom shrilled out in the silence, "Who says he is? It's true. Old bastard's kicked the bucket. He's dead as mutton." The boy laughed in giddy delight and capered along the edge of the pilings with his rifle waggling over his head. He vanished with a leap. Mallory found his voice. "Surely not." "No," Fraser agreed. "Not likely, anyway." "Wishful thinking on the part of these anarchists," Fraser suggested. There was a long, empty silence. "Of course," Mallory said, tugging his beard, "if the great orator truly is dead, then that means..." Words failed him in a foundering rush of confusion, but the others watched Mallory for guidance, silent and expectant. "Well," Mallory said, "the death of Byron would mark the end of an age of greatness." "It needn't mean much at all," Fraser objected, his voice under firm control. "There are many men of great talent in the party. Charles Babbage yet lives, Lord Colgate, Lord Brunel, the Prince Consort, for instance. Prince Albert is a sound and thoughtful man."
"Lord Byron can't be dead,"
Brian burst out.
"We're standing in stinking mud, believing a stinking lie."
"Quiet," Mallory commanded. "We'll simply have to suspend any judgment on this matter until we have firm evidence."
"Ned's right," nodded Tom. "The Prime Minister would have wanted it that way. That's the scientific method. That was what Lord Byron always taught us."
A thick, tarred rope, its end knotted in a fat noose, came snaking down the wall. The anarchist lieutenant, the dainty man with the paisley kerchiefs, posed one bent leg atop the wall, with his elbow on his knee and his chin in his hand. "Put your arse in that, my friend," he suggested, "and we'll hoist you up in a trice." "I thank you kindly," Mallory said. He waved with cheery confidence and stepped into the noose. When the tug came, he braced his mud-caked shoes against the slick and nasty timbers and stamped his way up and over the top. The leader tossed the emptied noose back down with a kid-gloved hand. Welcome, sir, to the august company of the vanguard of mankind. Permit me, under the circumstances, to introduce myself. I am the Marquis of Hastings. The self-styled Marquis bowed slightly, then struck a pose, chin cocked, one gloved fist poised on his hip. Mallory saw that the fellow was in earnest. The title of Marquis was a relic from the years before the Rads, yet here was a young pretender of some sort, a living fossil, alive and in command of this viper's crew. Mallory could scarcely have been more startled to see a young plesiosaur lift its snaky head from the depths of the stinking Thames. "Lads," drawled the young Marquis, "pour some of that cologne over our pungent friend. If he does anything stupid, you know what to do." "Shoot him," someone blurted idiotically. The Marquis winced elaborately, an actor's gesture indicating a breach of taste. A boy in a stolen copper's helmet and a ripped silk shirt slopped chill cologne from a cut glass bottle over Mallory's bare neck and back. Brian rose next, at the end of the rope. "Those are soldiers' trousers under that muck," the Marquis observed. "Absent without leave, comrade?" Brian shrugged mutely. "Enjoying your little holiday in London?" Brian nodded like a fool. "Give this filthy personage new trousers," the Marquis commanded. He looked about his little troop of six, who were once again lowering the line with the clumsy enthusiasm of a May Day tug-of-war. "Comrade Shillibeer, you're about this man's size. Give him your trousers." "Aw, but Comrade Marquis." "To each according to his needs, Comrade Shillibeer. Doff the garment at once." Shillibeer climbed clumsily out of his trousers and proffered them up. He wore no undergarments, and he tugged nervously at his shirt tails with one hand. "For heaven's sake," the Marquis said quizzically, "must I tell you sheepish dullards every little thing?" He pointed sharply to Mallory. "You, take Shillibeer's place and haul that line. You, soldier, no longer the oppressor's minion, but a man entirely free. Put on Shillibeer's trousers. Comrade Shillibeer, quit that wriggling. You have nothing of which to be ashamed. You may go at once to the general depot for fresh garments." "Thank you, sir." "Comrade," the Marquis corrected. "Get something nice, Shillibeer, and bring more cologne." Tom came up next, Mallory helping with the heaving. The bandits were badly hampered by their clattering, poorly slung rifles. These were general-issue Victoria carbines, heavy single-shot relics now consigned to native troops in the colonies. The rioters were rendered yet more clumsy by fearsome kitchen knives and homemade truncheons, stuffed at random into their looted finery. They wore gaudy scarves, sweaty silks, army bandoliers, and more resembled Turkish bashi bazooks than any kind of Briton. Two of them were scarcely more than boys, while another pair were thick-set, lumpish, thievish rascals, sodden with drink. The last, to Mallory's continued surprise, was a slender, silent negro, in the quiet dress of a gentleman's valet. The Marquis of Hastings examined Tom. "What is your name?"
"Tom, sir."
The Marquis pointed. "What's his name?"
"Ned."
"And him?"
"Brian," Tom said. "I think."
"And what, pray, is the name of that grim-looking cove below, looking so awfully much like a copper?" Tom hesitated.
"Don't you know?"
"He never gave us any proper name," Mallory broke in. "We just call him the Reverend." The Marquis glared at Mallory.
"We only met the Reverend today, sir," Tom apologized glibly. "We ain't what you'd call bosom pals."
"Suppose we leave him down there, then," the Marquis suggested.
"Haul him up," Mallory countered. "He's clever."
"Oh, and what of you, Comrade Ned? You're not half so stupid as you pretend, it seems, and you're not very drunk."
"Then give me a drink," Mallory said boldly, "and I could do with one of them carbines, too, if you're divvying loot."
The Marquis took note of Mallory's pistol, then cocked his masked head and winked, as if they were sharing a joke.
"All things in time, my eager friend," he said. He waved his neat gloved hand.
Very well, haul him. Fraser rose within the noose. So, Reverend, said the Marquis, what, pray, might be your denomination? Fraser shook the rope loose and stepped out. What do you think, Governor? I'm a bleeding Quaker. There was evil laughter. Fraser, pretending a loutish pleasure at the other's fun, shook his gingham-masked head. No, he rasped, no Quaker I, for I'm a panty-sucker. The laughter stopped short. Panty-sucker, Fraser insisted. One of them yellowback Yankee ranters. The Marquis broke in with chill precision. A pantisocrat, do you mean? That is to say, a lay preacher of the Susquehanna Phalanstery? Fraser stared dumbly at the Marquis. I refer to the utopian doctrines of Professor Coleridge and Reverend Wordsworth, the Marquis persisted with gentle menace. Right, Fraser grunted. One of them. That seems to be a copper's sling and pistol that you carry, my pacifistic pantisocrat friend. Got it from a copper, didn't I? He paused. A dead'un. There was laughter again, broken with coughs and grunts. The boy standing next to Mallory elbowed one of the older louts. This stinks turning me head, Henry. Can't we hook it? Ask the Marquis, Henry said. You ask him, the boy wheedled. He always makes such fun of me. Hearken now, said the Marquis. Jupiter and I shall escort the new recruits to the general depot. The rest of you shall continue shore patrol. The remaining four groaned in dissent. Don't deviate, the Marquis chided. You know that all the comrades get a turn at river duty, same as you. The Marquis, followed closely by the negro, Jupiter, led the way along the embankment. It astonished Mallory that the fellow would turn his back on four armed strangers, an act of either errant foolishness or sublimely careless bravery. Mallory traded silent glances, full of meaning, with Tom, Brian, and Fraser. All four still bore their weapons, the anarchists having not even troubled to confiscate them. It would be the work of moments to shoot their guide in the back, and perhaps the negro too, though the black was unarmed. A vile business, though, striking from behind, though perhaps a necessity of war. But the others were shifting itchily as they walked, and Mallory realized that they looked to him to do the deed. This venture had become his now, and even Fraser had bet his life on the fortunes of Edward Mallory. Mallory edged forward, matching his stride with that of the Marquis of Hastings. What's in this depot of yours, your lordship? A deal of fine loot, I should hope. A deal of fine hope, my looting friend. But never you mind that. Tell me this, Comrade Ned. What would you do with loot if you had it? I suppose that might depend on what it was, Mallory ventured. You'd carry it back to your rat warren, the Marquis surmised, and sell it for a fraction of its worth to a fencing Jew, and spend the lot of that on drink, to wake in a day or two in a filthy station house with a copper's foot on your neck. Mallory stroked his chin. What would you do with it, then? Put it to use, of course. We shall use it in the cause of those who gave it value. By that I mean the common folk of London, the masses, the oppressed, the sweated labor, those who produce all the riches of this city. That's a queer sort of talk, Mallory said. The revolution does not loot, Comrade Ned. We sequester, we commandeer, we liberate. You and your friends were drawn here by a few imported gewgaws. You think to carry off what your hands can clutch in a few moments. Are you men or magpies? Why settle for a pocketful of dirty shillings? You could own London, the modern Babylon herself. You could own futurity. Futurity, eh? Said Mallory, glancing back at Fraser. Above his gingham mask, the policeman's eyes showed unmitigated loathing. Mallory shrugged. How much tin will a quart of futurity fetch, your lordship? I thank you not to call me that, the Marquis said sharply. You address a veteran of popular revolution, a people's soldier who takes pride in the simple title of comrade. Begging your pardon, I'm sure. You're not a fool, Ned. You can't mistake me for a rad lord. I'm no bourgeois meritocrat. I am a revolutionary, and a mortal enemy by blood and conviction of the Byron tyranny and all its works. Mallory coughed harshly, cleared his throat. All right, then, he said in a new and sharper voice. What's all this talk about? Seizing London. You can't be serious. That hasn't been done since William the Conqueror. Read your history, friend, the Marquis retorted. Wat Tyler did it. Cromwell did it. Byron himself did it. He laughed. The people risen have seized New York City. The working people rule Manhattan as we walk and speak here. They have liquidated the rich. They have burned Trinity. They have seized the means of information and production. If mere Yankees can do that, then the people of England, far more advanced along the course of historical development, can do it with even greater ease. It was clear to Mallory that the man, the lad, rather, for beneath that mask and swagger he was very young, believed this evil madness with a whole heart. But the government, Mallory protested, will send in the army. Kill their officer class, and the army rank and file will rise with us, the Marquis said coolly. Look at your soldier friend Brian there. He seems happy enough in our company. Aren't you, Comrade Brian? Brian nodded mutely, waving a filth-smeared hand. You don't yet grasp the genius of our captain's strategy, the Marquis said. We stand in the heart of the British capital, the one area on earth that Britain's imperial elite are unwilling to devastate in the pursuit of their evil hegemony. The rad lords will not shell and burn their own precious London to quell what they falsely think a period of passing unrest. But, he raised one gloved forefinger, when we mount the barricade throughout this city, then they will have to struggle hand to hand with an aroused working class, men nerved to the marrow with the first true freedom they have ever known. The Marquis stopped a moment, wheezing for breath at the fetid air. Most of the oppressor class, he continued, coughing, have already fled London to escape the stink. When they attempt to return, the risen masses will meet them with fire and steel. We will fight them from the rooftops, from doorways, alleyways, sewers, and rookeries. He paused to dab his nose with a snotty kerchief from his sleeve. We will sequester every sinew of organized oppression. The newspapers, the telegraph lines and pneumatic tubeways, the palaces and barracks and bureaus. We will put them all to the great cause of liberation. Mallory waited, but it seemed that the young fanatic had at last run out of steam. And you want us to help you, eh? Join this people's army of yours? Of course. What's in it for us, then? Everything, the Marquis said. Forever. There were handsome ships moored inside the West India docks, tangled rigging and steamer stacks. The water within the docks, a byway from the sewage flow of the Thames, did not seem quite so foul to Mallory, until he saw, floating amid thin wads of slime, the bodies of dead men. Murdered sailors, the skeleton crews that shipping lines left to guard their ships in harbor. The corpses floated like driftwood, a sight to chill the marrow. Mallory counted 15 bodies, possibly 16, as he followed the Marquis along the gantry-shrouded wooden dockway. Perhaps, he theorized, most of the crews had been killed elsewhere, or else recruited to swell the ranks of Swing's piracy. Not all sailors were loyal to order and authority. The Ballester Molina pistol was a cold weight against Mallory's gut. The Marquis and his black led them blithely on. They passed a deserted ship where an ugly vapor, steam or smoke, curled up ominously from the hatches below decks. A quartet of anarchist guards, their carbines propped in a crude stack, played cards atop a barricade of bales of looted calico. Other guards, drunken, whiskered wretches in bad plug hats and worse trousers, armed derelicts, slept in toppled barrows and loading sledges, amid a swelling debris of barrels, baskets, hawser coils, and loading ramps, heaps of black coal for the silent steam derricks. From the warehouses across the water, to the south, came a ragged volley of distant popping gunshots. The Marquis showed no interest, did not break stride, did not even look. "You overpowered all these ships?" Mallory inquired. "You must have a deal of men, Comrade Marquis." "More by the hour," the Marquis assured him. "Our men are combing Limehouse, rousing every working family. Do you know the term exponential growth, Comrade Ned?" "Why, no," Mallory lied. "Mathematical clacking term," the Marquis lectured absently. "Very interesting field, engine clacking. No end of use in the scientific study of socialism." He seemed distracted now, nervous. "Another day of stink like this and we'll have more men than the London police force. You're not the first coves I've recruited, you know. I'm quite an old hand at it by now. Why, I wager even my man Jupiter could do it." He slapped the shoulder of the Negro's livery coat. The Negro showed no reaction. Mallory wondered if he were deaf and dumb. He wore no breathing mask. Perhaps he did not need one. The Marquis led them to the greatest among a series of warehouses. Even among the stellar names of commerce, Whitby's, Evan Hare, Aaron, Madras and Pondicherry Company, this was a very palace of mercantile modernity. Its vast loading doors had risen on a clever system of jointed counterweights, revealing an interior of steel frame construction, with translucent plate glass vaulting a roof that stretched wide and long as a soccer green. Below this roof grew a maze of steel braces, a fretwork of ratchets and wheeled tracking, where engine-driven pulley carts could run along like spiders. Somewhere pistons chugged with the familiar popping racket of an engine printing press. But the press was hidden somewhere behind a maze of booty to stupefy a Borgia. Merchandise lay in heaps, haystacks, mountains. Brocades, lounge chairs, carriage wheels, epergnes and chandeliers, tureens, mattresses, iron lawn dogs and parry and bird baths, billiard tables and liquor cabinets, bedsteads and stair newels, rolled rugs and marble mantelpieces. "Struth!" Tom cried. "How did you do all this?" "We've been here for days now," the Marquis said. He tugged the kerchief from his face, revealing a pale visage of almost girlish beauty with a downy blonde mustache. "There are goods in plenty still in the other godowns, and you shall all have a chance for a turn at the sledge and barrow. It's grand fun, and it's yours, for it belongs to all of us equally." "All of us?" Mallory said. "Of course, all the comrades." Mallory pointed at the Negro. "What about him?" "What? My man Jupiter?" The Marquis blinked. "Jupiter belongs to all of us, too, of course. He's not my servant alone, but the servant of the common good." The Marquis mopped his dripping nose on a kerchief. "Follow me." The heaping of booty had made a monster rat's nest of the warehouse's scientific storage plan. Following the Marquis, they picked their way across shoals of broken crystal, puddles of cooking oil, a crunchy alleyway littered with peanut holes. "Odd," the Marquis muttered. "When last I was here, the comrades were all about the place." The heaps of goods dwindled toward the rear of the warehouse. They passed the whacking printing press, hidden from sight in a cul-de-sac of towering bundles of newsprint. Someone threw a bundle of wet printing bills over the barricade, almost striking the Marquis, who hopped deftly over it. Mallory became aware of a distant voice, high-pitched and shrill. At the very rear of the warehouse, a large section of floor space had been made into an impromptu lecture hall. A chalkboard, a table piled with glassware, and a lectern all sat unsteadily on a stage of close-packed soap crates. Mismatched sets of cheap dining chairs, in pressed oak and maple veneer, served as seating for a silent audience of perhaps 70. "So, here they are," said the Marquis, with an odd quaver in his voice. "You're in luck. Dr. Barton is favoring us with an exposition. Seat yourselves at once, comrades. You will, I assure you, find this well worth your attention." To his vast surprise, Mallory found himself and his companions forced to join the audience in the final row of chairs. The Negro remained standing, hands clasped behind his back, at the rear of the hall. Mallory, seated next to the Marquis, rubbed his smarting eyes in disbelief. "This speaker of yours is wearing a dress."
"Hush!"
the Marquis whispered urgently. The female lecturer, brandishing a chalk-tipped ebony pointer, was hectoring the seated crowd in a voice of shrill but closely measured fanaticism. The strange acoustics of the makeshift hall warped her words as if she were speaking through a drumhead. Some kind of queer temperance lecture, it seemed, for she was decrying the poison alcohol and its threat to the revolutionary spirit of the working class. She had flasks, great glass-stoppered carboys, full of liquor on her table. They were labeled with the skull and crossbones, amid a truck of distillation flasks, red rubber tubing, wire cages, and laboratory gas rings. Tom, at Mallory's right, tapped Mallory's arm and whispered in a voice of near terror,
"Ned! Ned! Is that Lady Ada?"
"My God, boy," Mallory hissed, the hair prickling in fear all across his arms and neck.
"What makes you think that? Of course it isn't she."
Tom looked relieved, puzzled, vaguely offended.
"Who is it, then?"
The lecturing female turned to the chalkboard and wrote, in a ladylike cursive, the words, "Neurasthenic degeneracy." She turned, aimed a false and brilliant smile at the audience over her shoulder, and for the first time Mallory recognized her. She was Florence Russell Bartlett. Mallory stiffened in his chair with a half-stifled gasp of shock. Something, a fleck of dry cotton from within his mask, lodged like a barb in his throat. He began coughing, and he could not stop. His slimy throat was lacerated. He tried to smile, to whisper a word of apology, but his windpipe seemed pinched in iron bands. Mallory fought the racking spasms with all his strength, hot tears gushing freely, but he could not stop himself, nor even muffle the nightmare hacking. It called a deadly attention to him like a costermonger's bellow. At last Mallory jerked to his feet, knocking his chair back with a clatter, and staggered away, half-bent, half-blinded. He tottered, arms outstretched, through the blurry wilderness of booty, his feet tangling in something, some wooden object falling with a clatter. Somehow he found a spot of shelter, and bent there, shaking violently, his breath choked now by a loathsome bolus of phlegm and vomit. "I could die from this," he thought in desperation, his eyes bulging in their sockets. "Something will rupture. My heart will burst." Then somehow the clog was gone, the fit defeated. Mallory drew a ragged squeak of air, coughed, found his wind, and began to breathe. He wiped foul spittle from his beard with his bare hand, and found himself leaning against a piece of statuary. It was a life-sized Hindu maiden in Coates's patent artificial stone, half-nude, with a water jug poised on her draperied hip. The jug was solid stone, of course, though every atom in him cried out for a cleansing sip of water. Someone clapped him firmly on the back. He turned, expecting Tom O'Brien, and found the Marquis there. "Are you quite all right?"
"A passing fit," Mallory croaked.
He waved one hand, unable to straighten. The Marquis slipped a curved silver flask into his hand. "Here," he said, "this will help." Mallory, expecting brandy, tilted the flask to his lips. A treacly concoction, tasting vaguely of licorice and elm, flooded his mouth. He swallowed reluctantly.
What is this?"
"One of Dr. Barton's herbal remedies," the Marquis told him. "A specific against the foetor. Here, let me soak your mask in it. The fumes will clear your lungs."
"I'd rather you didn't," Mallory rasped.
"Are you fit, then, to return to the lecture?"
"No."
"No." The Marquis looked skeptical. "Dr. Barton is a medical genius. She was the first woman ever to graduate with honors from Heidelberg. If you knew the wonders she's worked among the sick in France, the poor wretches given up for dead by the so-called experts."
"I know," Mallory blurted.
Something like strength returned to him, and with it a strong urge to throttle the Marquis, shake this damned and dangerous little fool till the nonsense squeezed out of him like paste. He felt a suicidal urge to blurt out the truth, that he knew this Barton to be a poisoner, an adulteress, a vitrioleuse, wanted by police in at least 2 countries. He could whisper that confession, then kill the Marquis of Hastings and stuff his wretched body under something. The fit left him, replaced with a rational cunning, cold and brittle as ice. "I should rather talk with you, comrade," said Mallory, "than listen to any lecture."
"Really?" said Hastings, brightening.
Mallory nodded earnestly.
I find I always profit by listening to a man who truly knows his business."
"I cannot make you out, comrade," the Marquis said. "Sometimes you seem to me a typical self-seeking fool, but then again you seem a man of quite sophisticated understanding, certainly a cut above those friends of yours."
"I've traveled a bit," Mallory said slowly. "I suppose it broadens a man."
"Traveled where, comrade?"
Mallory shrugged. "Argentina, Canada, on the continent here and there."
The Marquis glanced about them, as if looking for spies alurk in the bird baths and chandeliers. When none showed, he seemed to relax a bit, then spoke with a renewed but quiet urgency.
"Might you know the American South at all? The Confederacy?"
Mallory shook his head.
"There's a city called Charleston, in South Carolina, a charming town. It has a large community of well-born British exiles who fled the Reds, Britain's ruined cavaliers."
"Very nice," Mallory grunted.
"Charleston is as refined and cultured a city as any in Britain."
"And you were born there, eh?"
Mallory had blundered to speak this deduction aloud, for Hastings was sensitive about it and frowned.
Mallory hastened on. "You must have prospered in Charleston to own a Negro."
"I do hope you are not an anti-slavery bigot," the Marquis said. "So many Britons are. I suppose you would have me pack poor Jupiter off to one of those fever-ridden jungles in Liberia."
Mallory restrained his nod of agreement. He was, in fact, an abolitionist and a supporter of Negro repatriation.
"Poor Jupiter wouldn't last a day in the Liberian Empire," the Marquis insisted. "You know he can read and write. I myself taught him. He even reads poetry."
"Your Negro reads verse?"
"Not verse. Poesy. The great poets. John Milton. But you've never heard of him, I wager."
"One of Cromwell's ministers," Mallory said readily. "Author of the Areopagitica."
The Marquis nodded. He seemed pleased. "John Milton wrote an epic poem, Paradise Lost. It's a biblical story, in blank verse."
"I'm an agnostic myself," Mallory said.
"Do you know the name of William Blake? He wrote and illustrated his own books of poems."
"Couldn't find a proper publisher, eh?"
"There are still fine poets in England. Did you ever hear of John Wilson Croker? Winthrop Mackworth Praed? Brian Waller Proctor?"
"I might have," Mallory said. "I read a bit, penny dreadfuls mostly." He was puzzled by the Marquis's strange interest in this arcane topic, and Mallory was worried about Tom and the others, what they must be thinking as they sat and waited for him. They might lose all patience and try something rash, and that wouldn't do.
"Percy Bysshe Shelley was a poet, before he led the Luddites in the time of troubles," the Marquis said. "Know that Percy Shelley lives. Byron exiled him to the island of St. Helena. He remains a prisoner there, in the manse of Napoleon I. Some say he's since written whole books of plays and sonnets there."
"Nonsense," Mallory said. "Shelley died in prison ages ago."
"He lives," the Marquis said. "Not many know that."
"Next you'll be saying that Charles Babbage wrote poetry," Mallory said, his nerves raw. "What's the point of this?"
"It's a theory of mine," the Marquis said. "Not so much a proper theory as a poetic intuition. But since studying the writings of Karl Marx, and of course the great William Collins, it has come to me that some dire violence has been done to the true and natural course of historical development."
The Marquis paused, smirked. But I doubt you can understand me, my poor fellow. Mallory shook his head roughly. I understand well enough. A catastrophe, you mean?
Yes, you might well call it that.
History works by catastrophe. It's the way of the world, the only way there is, has been, or ever will be. There is no history. There is only contingency. The Marquis's composure shattered.
You're a liar.
Mallory felt the foolish insult gall him to the quick. Your head's full of phantoms, boy. History. You think you should have a title and estates, and I should rot in Lewis making hats. There's nothing more to it than that. You little fool, the Rads don't care tuppence for you or Marx or Collins or any of your poetic mummeries. They'll kill the lot of you here like rats in a sawdust pit.
You're not what you seem, the Marquis said. He had gone as white as paper. Who are you? What are you?
Mallory tensed. The boy's eyes widened.
A spy!
He went for his gun. Mallory punched him full in the face. As the Marquis reeled back, Mallory caught his arm and clubbed him once, twice across the head with the heavy barrel of the Ballister Molina. The Marquis fell, bleeding. Mallory snatched up the second pistol, rose, glanced about him. The Negro stood not 5 yards away.
I saw that, Jupiter said quietly.
Mallory was silent. He leveled both guns at the man.
You struck my master.
Have you killed him?
I think not, Mallory said.
The Negro nodded. He spread his open palms gently, a gesture like a blessing.
You were right, sir, and he was quite wrong. There is nothing to history. No progress, no justice. There is nothing but random horror.
That's as may be, Mallory said slowly. But if you cry out, I will have to shoot you.
If you had killed him, I should have certainly cried out, the Negro said.
Mallory glanced back. He's still breathing. There was a long silence. The Negro stood quite still, his posture stiff and perfect, undecided, unmoving, like a platonic cone balanced perfectly upon its needle tip, waiting for some impetus beyond causality to determine the direction of its fall. The Negro sighed.
I'm going back to New York City, he said.
He turned on one polished heel and walked away, unhurried, vanishing into the looming barricades of goods. Mallory felt quite certain that the man would not cry out, but he waited a few moments for the evidence that would confirm that belief. The Marquis stirred where he lay and groaned. Mallory whipped the paisley kerchief from the man's curly head and gagged him with it. It was the work of a moment to shove him behind a massive terracotta urn. The shock of action had left Mallory dry. His throat felt like bloodied sandpaper. There was nothing to drink, except, of course, that silver flask of quack potion. Mallory dragged it by feel from the Marquis's jacket pocket and wet his throat. It left a numbing tingle at the back of his palate, like dry champagne. It was vile, but it seemed to be bracing him somehow. He helped himself to a number of swallows. Mallory returned to the lecture area and took a seat beside Fraser. The policeman lifted one brow in silent query. Mallory patted the butt of the Marquis's pistol, lodged within his waistband opposite the Ballister Molina. Fraser nodded by a fraction. Florence Russell Bartlett was continuing her harangue, her stage manner seeming to afflict her audience with an occult paralysis. Mallory saw to his shock and disgust that Mrs. Bartlett was displaying quack devices intended to avert pregnancy, a disc of flexible rubber, a wad of sponge with a thread attached. Mallory could not avoid the dark imagining of coitus involving these queer objects. The thought made his gut lurch.
She killed a rabbit a moment ago, Fraser hissed from the corner of his mouth. Dipped its nose in essence of cigar.
I didn't kill the boy, Mallory whispered in return. Concussed, I think. He watched Bartlett as her rant drifted into queer plans for selective breeding to improve the stock of humanity. In her futurity, it seemed, proper marriage would be abolished. Universal free love would replace chastity. Reproduction would be a matter for experts. The concepts swam like dark shadows at the shore of Mallory's mind. It struck him then, for no seeming reason, that this day, this very afternoon in fact, was the time specified for his own triumphant lecture on the Brontosaurus, with kinetrope accompaniment by Mr. Keats. The fearful coincidence sent a queer shiver through him. Brian leaned suddenly across Fraser, seizing Mallory's bare wrist in a grip of iron. Ned, he hissed, let's get out of this damned place. Not yet, Mallory said. But he was shaken. A mesmeric flow of sheer panic seemed to jolt into him, through Brian's grip. We don't know yet where Swing is hiding. He could be anywhere in this warren. Comrades! Bartlett sang out, in a voice like an iced razor. Yes, you four, in the back. If you must disturb us, if you have news of such pressing interest, then surely you should share it with the other comrades in the Chautauqua. The four of them froze. Bartlett raked them with a Medusa glare. The other listeners, freed somehow from their queer bondage, turned to glare backward with bloodthirsty glee. The eyes of the crowd glowed with a nasty pleasure, the relief of wretches who find their own destined punishment falling elsewhere. Tom and Brian spoke both at once in frenzied whispers. Does she mean us? My God, what do we do? Mallory felt trapped in nightmare. A word would break it, he thought. She's just a woman, he said, quite loudly and calmly.
Knife it, Fraser hissed. Be still.
Nothing to tell us, Bartlett taunted. I thought not. Mallory rose to his feet. I do have something to say. With the speed of jack-in-the-boxes, three men rose from within the audience, their hands raised. Dr. Barton! Dr. Barton! Bartlett nodded graciously, gestured with the chalk wand. Comrade Pye has the floor. Dr. Barton, cried Pye, I do not recognize these comrades. They are behaving regressively, and I think they should be criticized. A fierce silence wrapped the crowd. Fraser yanked at Mallory's trouser leg. Sit down, you fool. Have you lost your mind? I do have news, Mallory shouted through his gingham mask. News for Captain Swing. Bartlett seemed shocked. Her eyes darted back and forth. Tell it to all of us, then, she commanded. We're all of one mind here. I know where the modus is, Mrs. Bartlett, Mallory shouted. Do you want me to tell that to all these dupes and slaveys? Chairs clattered as men leapt to their feet. Bartlett shrieked something, lost in the noise. I want Swing. I must speak to him alone. As chaos rose, Mallory kicked the empty chair before him into skidding flight and yanked both pistols from his belt. Sit down, you bastards! He leveled his pistols at the audience. I'll blow daylight through the first coward that stirs! His answer was a fusillade of shots. Run! Brian screeched. He, Tom, and Fraser fled at once. Chairs splintered, toppling on either side of Mallory. The audience was shooting at him, ragged, popping shots. Mallory leveled both his pistols at Bartlett at her podium and squeezed the triggers. Neither gun fired. He had neglected to cock the hammers. The Marquis's gun seemed to have some kind of nickeled safety switch. Someone nearby threw a chair at Mallory. He fended it off absently, but then something struck him hard in the foot. The blow was sharp enough to numb his leg and knock him from his stance. He took the opportunity to retreat. He could not seem to run properly. Perhaps he had been crippled. Bullets sang past him with a nostalgic drone from far Wyoming. Fraser beckoned at him from the mouth of a side alley. Mallory ran to him, turned, skidded. Fraser stepped coolly into the open, raising his copper's pepper box in a dueling stance, right arm extended, body turned to present a narrow target, head held keen-eyed and level. He fired twice, and there were screams. Fraser took Mallory's arm. This way. Mallory's heart was jumping like a rabbit, and he could not get his foot to work. He limped down the alley. It ended abruptly. Fraser searched frantically for a crawlway. Tom was boosting Brian atop a great unsteady heap of cotton. Mallory stopped beside his brothers, turned, raised both pistols. He glanced down swiftly at his foot. A stray bullet had knocked the heel from his shoe. He looked up an instant later to see half a dozen screaming bandits approaching in hot pursuit. A vast concussion shook the building. Heaps of tinned goods clattered to the floor in a billow of powder smoke. Mallory gaped. All six of the wretches lay sprawled and blasted in the alley, as if lightning struck. "Ned!" shouted Brian from atop his heap of cotton. "Get their weapons!" He crouched there on one knee, the Russian pistol gushing smoke from its opened loading chamber. He loaded a second cartridge of brass and red waxed paper, as thick as a copper's baton. Mallory, ears ringing, lunged forward, then slipped and almost fell headlong in the spreading blood. He grabbed right-handed for support, and the Ballister Molina went off, its bullet whanging from an iron beam overhead. Mallory paused, uncocked it carefully, uncocked the Marquis's pistol as well, sucked them both into his belt, precious seconds ticking as he dithered. The alley was awash with blood. The blunderbuss blast of the Russian hand cannon had lacerated the men hideously. One poor devil was still gurgling as Mallory pried a Victoria carbine from beneath him, its stock dripping red. He struggled with the fellow's bandolier, but gave that up for another's wooden-handled Yankee revolver. Something stung his palm as he snatched up the pistol. Mallory looked stupidly at his wounded hand, then at the pistol butt. There was a corkscrewed bit of hot shrapnel embedded in the wood, a razored thing like a big metal shaving. Rifles began to crack from a distance, slugs plowing into the bounty around them, with odd crunches and a musical tinkling of glass. "Mallory, this way!" Fraser shouted. Fraser had uncovered a crevice along the warehouse wall. Mallory turned to sling the carbine and look for Brian, seeing the young artilleryman leap across the alley for another vantage point. He followed Fraser into the crevice, grunting and heaving, for several yards along the wall. Bullets began whacking into the brick, before them and behind them, but well above their heads. Ill-aimed shots burst the tin-sheet roof with drum-like metal bangs. Mallory emerged to find Tom working like a demon in an open cul-de-sac, flinging up a barricade of spindle-legged ladies' vanity tables. The things lay piled in a white lacquered heap, like dead tropical spiders. The cracking of rifles, sharper now, made the warehouse a cacophony. From behind them, Mallory heard shouts of rage and fear over the dead. Tom drove a length of iron bedstead into a heap of crates, put his back into it, and toppled the mess with a crash. "How many?" Tom panted. "Six." Tom smiled like a madman. "That's more than they'll ever kill of us. Where's Brian now?" "I don't know." Mallory unslung the carbine, handed it to Tom. Tom took it by the barrel and held it at arm's length, surprised by its caking of gore. Fraser, maintaining close watch at the crevice, fired his pepper box. There was an awful girlish scream and a thrashing, like a poisoned rat in a wall. Bullets began to plunge into the rubble around them with somewhat greater accuracy, attracted by the scream. A thumb-sized conical slug fell from nowhere at Mallory's feet and spun like a top on the floorboard. Fraser tapped his shoulder. Mallory turned. Fraser had tugged the mask from his face. His eyes glittered and stubble showed black on his pale chin. "How now, Dr. Mallory? What new inspired maneuver?" "That might well have worked, you know," Mallory protested. "She might have taken us straight to swing if she'd believed me. There's no accounting for women."
"Oh, she believed you right enough," said Fraser.
And suddenly he laughed, a strange dry chuckling, like the rubbing of resined wood.
"Well, what do you have there?"
"Pistol?" Mallory offered Fraser the salvaged revolver. "Mind that bit of shrapnel in it." Fraser scraped the embedded barb free on his boot heel. Never saw the like of that lad's barker. I rather doubt it's legal, even for one of your gallant Crimea heroes. A rifle shot knocked a spinning chunk from one of the vanity tables, narrowly missing Fraser. Mallory looked up, startled.
Damn!
A distant sniper clung monkey-like to one of the iron rafters, fitting another round into his rifle. Mallory snatched the Victoria from Tom, braced the bloodied strap around his forearm, and took close aim. He squeezed the trigger. To no effect, for the single shot had been fired already. But the sniper's mouth opened in an O of terror, and he leapt from his perch with a distant crash. Mallory yanked the bolt back, flinging the dead cartridge. I should have taken that damned bandolier. Ned! Brian appeared suddenly to their left, crouched at the top of a heap. Over here! Cotton bales!
Right.
They followed Brian's lead, scrambling and heaving atop the booty in a cascade of whalebone and candlesticks. Bullets whizzed and thwacked around them. More men in the rafters, Mallory thought, too busy to look. Fraser rose once and took a pot shot, to no apparent effect. Dozens of hundredweight bales of Confederate ginned cotton, wrapped in rope and burlap, had been stacked almost to the rafters. Brian gestured wildly, then vanished over the far side of the cotton stack. Mallory understood him. It was a natural fortress with a little work. He and Tom heaved and toppled one of the bales free from the top of the stack, stepping into the cavity. Bullets thumped with gentle huffs into the cotton as Fraser rose and returned fire. They kicked out another bale and then a third. Fraser joined them in the excavation with a leap and a stumble. In a frantic, heaving minute, they had burrowed their way into the thick of it, like ants amid a box of cube sugar. Their position was obvious now. Bullets popped and thudded into the cotton fortress, but to no effect. Mallory yanked a great clean wad and wiped sweat and blood from his face and arms. It was dire hard work hauling cotton bales. No wonder the Southerns had relegated it to their darkies. Fraser cleared a narrow space between two bales. Give me another pistol. Mallory handed him the Marquis's long-barreled revolver. Fraser squeezed off a shot, squinted, nodded. Fine piece. A volley of futile shots came in reply. Tom, grunting and heaving, cleared more space by lifting and dropping a bale off the back of the heap. It struck something with a crash like a splintering pianola. They took inventory. Tom had a Derringer with one loaded chamber. Useful, perhaps, if the anarchists swarmed in like boarding pirates, but not otherwise. Mallory's Ballister Molina had three rounds. Fraser's Pepperbox had three caps left, and the Marquis's gun five rounds. And they had an empty Victoria carbine, and Fraser's little truncheon. There was no sign of Brian. There were angry, muffled shouts in the depths of the warehouse. Orders, Mallory thought. The gunfire died away quite suddenly, replaced by an ominous silence, broken by rustling and what seemed to be hammering. End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.